Does anyone know what happened November 9th, 1989? Which wall? Good job. We're starting off hot. Okay. We're on fire. Yes, the Berlin Wall of East Germany came down, and East and West Germany became Germany. Fascism fell with World War II, and this was really the mark of communism falling with the wall. And it was considered the advent of liberalism. Another word for liberalism is liberal democracy. I'll get into that in a minute. It's a political philosophy of the West that liberty is for individuals, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, a free market, so capitalism often attends liberalism. There's a guy named Francis Fukuyama. It's my favorite photo, by the way. Isn't that romantic? Love wins. Anyway, so Francis Fukuyama is a guy that studied at Cornell and Harvard and now has a post at Stanford University. In 1989, he wrote a book called The End of History. The End of History, because he was marking the fall of the Berlin Wall as the end of history. What could he possibly mean? What he meant was that all of history led toward this inevitable progress to the best government possible. Fascism fell, communism fell, the advent of liberal democracy, Western democracy or liberalism. Some refer to as classical liberalism. So the world popped a bottle of champagne. It was very exciting. I remember sitting there watching TV with my family of this whole event. But I think that the next morning we woke up feeling that we had drunk a little bit too much champagne. What was I thinking? We certainly did not feel as if the world was on the edge of great freedom. The party was not living up to its hype. You had Derrida speak about this end of history, question mark. For it must be cried out at a time when some have the audacity to neo-evangelize in the name of the ideal of liberal democracy that has finally realized itself as the ideal of human history. Never have violence, inequality, exclusion, famine, and thus economic oppression affected as many human beings in the history of the earth and of humanity. He was not invited to the party. But he looks around and says, this isn't freedom for everybody. We see far too much inequality and economic oppression. With all these pressures happening on society, we need a stronger response to face all this violence, inequality, exclusion, famine, and more. We don't just want champagne. We want political leaders to step up and do something about it. But as political leaders have stepped in, liberal political leaders have stepped in to help, we feel that maybe there's been an overstep. It appears that it's encroaching through authoritarianism. So you have people who cry out fascism when they see someone like Trump. They cry out communism when they see Joe Biden. You can see that these were two ways of mocking them. But neither is actually totally accurate. What both Biden and Trump are liberals. Okay, that might sound strange. Okay. I hope you trust me for this ride, okay? We're going to get to somewhere where you're not throwing rocks at me, but hopefully we are for the better for it after. But just trust me. So liberalism sounds strange. What I mean by liberalism is liberal democracy, and let me explain its basic tenets. So before I do, you know, when we hear liberalism, we think Liberal Party. Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada. You think Joe Biden. You know, the Libs and the Dems. You think of Labour Party in England. But this is not what I mean at all. Okay? So if that's what you thought I was going to say, I wasn't. Liberalism is a political philosophy. And its basic tenets is trying to contend to secure the rights of its citizens by limiting forms of government. So the basic three aspects are individual rights, so inalienable freedoms based on human dignity, their ability to vote, popular vote, so we call it democracy, which, by the way, the Greeks considered the lowest form of government because it was mob rule. But because we believe in human dignity, it makes sense. And they vote for their leaders, but these people are constitutionally constrained by the individual's freedoms. So that is limited government. So you have an idea of limited government, popular vote, and individual rights. Now, people will disagree on the means and policies and the ways to do that and exactly how much power should each other have. But this is the basic form of liberalism, of liberal democracy. So, in considering that, so the basic freedoms that you would have, just to back up, the basic freedoms that these individual rights would, for example, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of press, freedom of religion, and so on, and also a free market. So freedom is a big word for Western liberalism. But under this, you would see Trump as a quote-unquote conservative liberal because he's for the free market. You would see Biden as a progressive liberal because of certain stances he takes on social morals. I had one of him. I wanted these two pictures because I thought maybe the true definition of what holds liberals together is that politicians hold their thumbs up. That's when we know we can trust them. So they disagree over the means and the policies, but they agree that we need to contend for the rights of citizens. They disagree on which citizens, which rights, so on, and how to do it. In the recent election between Trump and Biden, there was a graph describing the motivation of voters. And they showed Republican and Democrat. And what was surprising about it is how similar they were on what they were voting for. The difference were the extreme points, the far right and the far left. But there was 85% of the muddled middle that could be that could float one way or the other. Interesting. So if there's so much commonality, why is there so much fear of authoritarianism? Maybe you have some ideas, but let me have some words first. So how do we get here, and how are we to respond? I'm going to go through three ways of looking at it. Some suggest that the attacks on liberalism, the reason that it is collapsing into authoritarianism, is from outside, from without, that there's something foreign to liberalism itself that's causing this failure, this tendency toward authoritarianism. Another view is that the attacks on liberalism are from within. Liberalism is the problem itself. Liberal democracy and its foundations are the problem in and of itself. And then the last is that the attacks are actually from a loss of liberalism's Christian roots. Okay, so that's the order. Those are the three I'm going to look at. The first is that the attacks are on liberal democracy are coming from outside, from without. One person who's been writing about this a lot is Anne Applebaum. She's born American. married a Polish politician and has lived in Poland for over 20 years. She's a journalist and writes for The Spectator, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic. She won a Pulitzer Prize winning nonfiction called Gulag, A History. And she has written extensively on Marxist-Leninism. But recently she's turned her journalistic and historical eye toward the rise of authoritarianism within liberal societies and tries to explain why is it happening. In her book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, she starts this book talking about a party she had for Y2K, okay? The beginning of 2000, and she invited all her political friends and dignitaries over to their house, and they had a party, and she would consider herself conservative. But within a few years, and she said most people at the party, they had diverse political opinions. Most were conservative, but not all. But they had a party and they had fun. But she said now, after a couple of decades, the divisions are so deep that most of them don't talk to each other. It happened just within 20 years. And she says most of her friends have moved further right than she has. And in reaction, she's moved more to the middle. So she wants to know, how did this happen? And this is her explanation. This book is explaining it. And she tells a lot of personal anecdotes through leading political figures. She knows them by first name, and she knows them in relationship. And I feel like since the divisions were so deep, she didn't mind naming names and letting things burn. Okay. So that was one of my, you know, cringy moments reading the book. She seemed to be dropping lots of names. But she believes that the attack on liberal freedoms have occurred at a personal level, at a psychological level, that the affections have been so deeply shaped in society that have caused us to attack liberalism in an irrationality. People have just become irrational. And that's why they're attacking liberalism. And they're looking to other forms of fascism or Marxism, communism. Though her primary eye is her fear of fascism. And so she gives four main points about the reasons people have been moving toward authoritarianism, particularly to the right in her mind. First, she says, people just have big egos, and they are wounded, and they have now tried, once they got power, they're trying to get back at those other friends that they used to be friends with. That person outed them, they're going to out them, and they have a division. They're just wounded egos. Now, there's been several students that have come to Libri from Washington, D.C., working in D.C., and I hate to say that this is probably more true than I would like to admit, that people's petty egos and petty grievances can actually cause policy. The second, she was saying, is that there's a longing for the good old days. This restorative nostalgia, she calls it. You know those days that were so great when we had the power and everyone looked like us and everything was like us. It was just normal. I just wish that we could make America great again. Third, she says it's the use of media manipulation. There's lots of fake news. And people end up having their internet news feeds, and it just embroils them into more fear, into anger, and to activism, online activism. I call it couch potato activism. Dislike on Facebook, right? Or like on Facebook. Though it can divide families, right? It has divided families. I'm sure you've had friends and family members that have been divided over these issues. But she says that people are just online, and what's happening is that it's just firing them up, and all they're getting is misinformation or not the full information, and they're just reacting. And so people are just irrationally responding and acting. And then fourthly, there's an entrenched nationalistic exceptionalism. What she means is anti-immigration, anti-globalist mentality. As freedoms have expanded, people are getting nervous. They're losing power, and too much difference is happening at once. And so she's quite positive about liberalism or liberal democracy. But she feels that loyalists and nationalists are stoking fears against globalist movements. This movement that liberalism that Fukuyama spoke of was spreading across the world. And we're seeing liberalism spread across the world, and now we're getting fearful that it's out of our control. And so people are overreacting, and so they want populists. And she speaks of Hungary, she speaks of Poland, she speaks of England, and she speaks of America. She does not speak about America except a very little at the very end. And so she's quite positive. She says, if we just calm down, become rationalists again, we can move forward. And she writes, like refugees struggling to reach a distant goal on a dark path, we are forced to pick our way through the night without any clear idea of whether we will arrive. To some, the precariousness of the current moment seems frightening. And yet this uncertainty has always been there. Together, we can make old and misunderstood words like liberalism mean something again. Together, we can fight back against lies and liars. Together, we can rethink what democracy should look like in a digital age. So she's saying, with all this new stuff, the digital age and the media and all this, we can still have hope that liberalism will achieve its end goal, freedom for all. But we just need to tamp down fears and irrational responses. Okay, so let me have some critiques of Anne Applebaum. I believe that she simply reduces it to the emotional or psychological. It's far more complex. She thinks that, and Guilherme is going to speak about affections later, and affections are important about, you know, how we sense and feel. But she's talking about a particular affection, fear of difference. And what she's calling for is that we just need to go back to the Enlightenment, go back to cool rationalism, and if we were all thinking people, we would know that liberalism is the wisest idea and we would agree on the policies. So we just need to tamp down the emotions. But I believe that she reduces the problems by trying to reduce it merely to the emotional or merely to psychological. She believes that if we just have cool rationalism, we can return to the inevitable path of progress, the inevitable path of progress that liberalism gives us. But this is where I think it most deeply fails. It fails to appreciate people's real concerns of the failures of happening in society. An appeal to return to pluralistic and globalistic society fails to appreciate the pressure mounted into protests against systemic racial discrimination. The pressure of religious organizations having to concede on contemporary sexual mores because of what government policies do. The pressure of economic inflation and disparity, of packing courts of justice with partisan judges, of technological manipulation. All this seems to fall short of what is really needed. The real concern for authoritarianism is there because the needs are severe. We have severe needs in our society. There are severe concerns. So let's not reduce it to some petty irrationality that people might have. It's not enough. It seems like she's kept her head in the clouds. And so I love this verse in Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 14. They offer superficial treatments for my people's mortal wound. They give assurances of peace when there is no peace. So let's turn to Patrick Deneen. So this second part is faulty foundations from within. The attacks on liberalism is actually a part of liberalism itself. So this man is Patrick Deneen. He's a professor of political science at Notre Dame. You'll see how his Catholicism informs his thought. And he wrote a book called Why Liberalism Failed. I don't think I asked Jock to get it. It's an interesting book. It's a really good read. It's very helpful. But he says that, let's see if it's on the quote. He says that that we cannot, it's not just a set of discrete problems that are solvable by liberal tools. The problem is liberalism itself. Liberalism is the problem. Liberal democracy is the problem. Here are some quotes. Liberalism has failed not because it fell short, but because it was true to itself. It failed because it has succeeded. Also, to call for the cures of liberalism's ills by applying more liberal measures is tantamount to throwing gas on a raging fire. So he and Applebaum would not get along. Okay. And so in the book of Why Liberalism Failed, he looks to the faulty foundations of modern liberalism. So modern liberalism began with people like John Locke, Thomas Hobbes in the 1600s. And so he says the mistake was not that they wanted to pursue individual freedoms, equality, or justice for all. The mistake was that it was based on a false anthropology. It was based on a false understanding of what it means to be human. So Deneen's not a hater of America in his criticism of modern liberalism. He says that we should not discard some of liberalism's main commitments toward justice and dignity and freedom, but we must reject its false anthropology, its false foundation. Let's see. Oops. I think I went to... I was just touching buttons. Oh, no, I'm okay. So the ancient understanding of liberty, which is what Deneen really likes, the ancient, the Greek view, the Roman view of liberty, was to see humans as embedded creatures. Actually, maybe I'm right. Okay. Because individuals are embedded into a social history, in a culture, within a family, within natural constraints. We're not free-floating. And so from within these constraints of nature, we are to cultivate self-rule. We are to cultivate virtue. So that's why the Greeks were told, educated in virtue, so that they would know how to rule their own lives, rule their families, and rule cities. So in virtue, if you were virtuous, you were free, which a Christian can agree with. And so that's how these people were to cultivate their culture. Yet the understanding promoted by modern liberalism, not ancient liberalism, is that the human is free from all constraints. And so instead of self-rule embedded in a social system, that you are autonomous and you're seeking your own interests and we vote on that interest. So he says, human beings are thus by nature non-relational creatures, separate and autonomous. He's talking about what liberalism believes. Liberalism begins a project by which the legitimacy of all human relationships, beginning with but not limited to political bonds. That's what really is the one attachment we have. The legitimacy of all human relationships become increasingly dependent on whether those relationships have been chosen and chosen on the basis of their service to rational self-interest. So it doesn't matter where you were born, where you're from, your life is about what you have chosen, what you want to become. He says that's the basis of modern liberalism. So what does this mean? It sees that every individual is autonomous and rational, that one is not defined by the characteristics of their birth. In order to achieve true liberty, all characteristics of what makes one human secondary. Circumstances of place, history, religion, family, gender, sex are all accidental features that have to be chosen. That's the starting point as a political philosophy. And you can read John Locke and others to see that. So why would someone think that this is a good idea? Well, imagine being born black. One may be restricted by the color of their skin, by the place where they are, poverty. And so if a culture is colorblind, quote unquote, then it should enable their freedom. They're not defined by their characteristics. They're equal to all other autonomous people. So you can see the power of this argument. This was the argument for women and their ability to vote. They were equal to men by this accounting. And so Dineen supports these forms of justice that have been achieved. But here he argues that we should reject the basis from which we achieve this freedom because it imagines a person removed from their local place. So how might we achieve such freedom that liberalism promises, but being true to their circumstances? That's what Dineen is wanting to go for. But he's saying that this causes a huge problems. Huge problems when we start on the autonomous individual. Now this lecture is one that you have to really put your thinking cap on. I hope you're with me. Okay. Now, it offers one step forward, freedom, but there's two steps back. You know, when you fix a problem, you think, oh, if I just fix this, everything will be better. But then you realize you knock two different things out of order. That's what's happening here. So one's not held back by the accidents of birth. However, such freedom ends up devastating local culture. Think of Monsanto coming over to some local farm and making decisions for the local farm when they don't know what's happening, and they make the decisions from over here in Detroit. I'm not sure Monsanto is Detroit. I'm just making it up. And I'm not just picking on Detroit. Don't get worried. But just imagine someone's making a choice in Detroit for some farm in Iowa, and they don't even go to the land to see if it's appropriate for that land or that neighborhood. Okay? And so such freedom of such autonomy can devastate local culture. And so we see relationships disintegrate within liberalism. Marriages are easily dissoluble. There's a disregard for place in today's global market. Walmart taking over mom and pop shops, things. You see people's feeling of responsibility for their community wane. You even see relationship question to gender and sex. Freedom is no longer about self-rule or virtue or something natural, but autonomous freedom, the freedom of self-interest. And that's the basis of liberalism, the society in which we live. So beginning with this false understanding of human nature, we can devastate what's natural and necessary to what's fully human. There's a second problem, and I'm going to spend more time on this. That such freedom expands the power of the state. And so this is where Dineen's pointing to authoritarianism. Liberalism is cause of its own authoritarianism. How does that work? Dineen says liberalism establishes a deep and profound connection. Its ideal of liberty can be realized only through a powerful state. If the expansion of freedom is secured by law, then the opposite also holds true in practice. Increasing freedom requires the expansion of law. Now that's a very, very deep and profound sentence. I hope you catch it. That the expansion of freedom is secured by law, which also means that the more law freedom we have, the more law we have. So he goes on and say, ironically, the more completely the sphere of autonomy is secured, the more comprehensive the state must become. So when people cry out, we want freedom, we want our rights, they go to the government to make laws to legislate that freedom. So you can see that when we cry for freedom, it creates legislation. You see? I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying that we just have to recognize that that's the process that's happening. So without any intermediation, without any natural buffers of family, community, neighborhood, land, you have two entities in a liberal democracy, the individual and the state. Because the individual is autonomous. We've been seeking the autonomous freedom, and the state gives it. Okay? Are you with me? Okay. So let me give an example of how this works. So I'm from Canada, and the Charter has recast the definition of marriage. Back in 2001, I think, maybe 2002. From the natural condition of male and female to include persons of the same sex, what is commonly known as gay marriage. The concern arose from a desire by those who identify as gay to have the same freedoms that heterosexuals have to be able to marry the person they love. This is something I've done a lot of work on. And they also want to share the economic and legal benefits that that brings. So if you have a partner for 20 years and they die, you want to be able to have an inheritance from them. But if you don't have gay marriage, then it's very difficult to secure that according to the laws of the day. And so the court redefined marriage more openly with a gender-free definition. Okay, so what are the implications? Does it simply add freedoms? Does it simply add freedoms to the law and to the Charter? The Charter is our Bill of Rights. There's one person who's written extensively about this. His name is Douglas Farrow, from an article called Death of a Dictum and Other Misfortunes. He likes really long titles. So let me read this. I think you can follow it. So Bill C-38 is the marriage for a gay marriage, okay? It makes it a legal right. It's a redefinition of marriage, okay? It is not by accident that Bill C-38, in its consequential amendments, dismantles the language of natural parent, blood relationship, and the like. Language that acknowledges implicitly the priority of the family to the state in favor of terms such as legal parent and legal parent-child relationship. These alterations represent a larger restructuring of Canadian law in such a way as to reduce not only marriage, but the whole nexus of family relations to the status of a legal construct, thus bringing them under the control of the state and making them subject to whatever definitions the state wishes to impose upon them. Okay, so that's, if you caught that, it's very powerful. But what he's saying is that when they brought the bill gay marriage, it doesn't just add freedoms, but they have to redefine what makes a person relate to the person who gave them birth, the person who's their guardian. And so if you have two gay men or two gay women have a child, in terms of if there's a biological relationship, then you're going to say, okay, well, what's the relationship? Because the birth mother may not even be involved. So rather, it's important that these two persons have legal responsibility and accountability to the care of that child. But you remove the natural relationship to a legal relationship. And so what happens is that this relationship becomes a legal construct rather than a natural construct. You see? But the problem that he's saying is, but this removes all position, power, responsibility of what's natural for the legal, and now the state has power over the family and not the family itself. So what binds the child to the parent is not blood or biology, but law. Now, this has given many access to the institution of marriage, but it has given more control to the state. What we have seen are also consequences later on from this decision in Canada. For example, if a child wants to seek gender reassignment, there's been a case in Canada where the parent was overruled by the judge and the nurse and the teacher. In Canada, if children go to schools, and I've found that this is happening in America too, but children can go to school and have different expression at school, and the school will intentionally lie to the parents about it happening. I know a teacher in a Canadian school, and I said, does this really happen, or is this kind of like fear-mongering? And she goes, no, it's not only happening, it's affirmed. And she goes, we have a whole system in place that is systemic deceit for the parents. Because what's happening is that the public schools is a public entity of defining what the state needs to educate the children to, because they're educating them to a legal relationship rather than to the natural one, you see. So the expansion of the state when a call for freedoms and rights. How do we solve this? Now, Deneen didn't bring this example up. I did, because I know quite a bit about it. But I wanted to show it because it shows you that this is not some Marxist agenda, but a fulfillment of unmoored liberalism. Deneen, in fact, says that this devastation to culture and to nature is not just on the left, it's also on the right. It's bipartisan. While conservatives and progressives may differ on means, they both agree on the final end of achieving liberty. But the free market, like the global market, might actually devastate the local markets from the conservative side. Or you might devastate the family from the left side, you see? Okay, I'll back up. Yeah, I can give you more examples, but just if you want more examples, I can give them to you later. So this is why we experience the threat of authoritarianism in our midst, according to Deneen. He says, the liberties that liberalism was brought into being to protect individual rights of conscience, religion, association, speech, and self-governance are extensively compromised by the expansion of government activity into every area of life. So what he's saying is that liberalism is set to protect our individual rights, but the more we expand those individual rights, the more devastation they do to them. He's saying liberalism is a snake that eats its own tail because it's based on a false anthropology. It's eating up what's natural in order to serve the autonomous. It's breaking down thick forms of community. Maybe you've experienced in your own communities, when bureaucracy comes in, they don't understand your own local situation. A population seeking to fill the void, he says, is left by the weakening of moral local memberships and association, susceptible to a fanatical willingness to identify completely with a distant and abstract state. So what he's saying is that what's happening, local memberships are dissolving, local communities, local neighborhoods are dissolving, and they're becoming more bureaucratic. And what we have all, and so what we relate to is, you might say, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat. That's your identity. But your other parts of your identity can be weakened because of what's happening by the state's power. In spite of all this, Deneen is not saying that we need to get rid of liberalism. He's saying we need to improve it. We need to return to a healthy understanding of what it means to be human. He says we must build upon those achievements of liberalism while abandoning the foundational reasons for its failures. Well, how does he expect to do this? It comes up in this one. I won't read it because it's quite long. But he's saying that we need to be aware of its ideologies, but we need to be guided by liberalism's own retention of essential concepts from a pre-liberal age. What he's saying, we need to return to the ancient. The problem is the modern liberalism, when we started setting it on the autonomous, which the Enlightenment did. We need to return to the ancient categories of Greece and Rome, where they saw things that were natural, where people were socially embedded. That's what we need to return to. We need to recover a better human anthropology. We need to learn what it means to be free in community, in our neighborhoods. And so instead of cultureless people, we need to cultivate locally. So if we feed local human culture, it will benefit larger national culture. So let's not just vote for the president, but let's get involved in our neighborhoods. and be informed out of that kind of voting, that kind of attention, letting Christian communities and Mormon communities and Hindu communities and all these kind of communities making their decisions and functioning in neighborhoods, and out of that creating, let that local culture and those local votes shape national culture. And I really like that he wants to return to local forms of civic participation. That's something that Canada, I do believe, or at least in my experience, does better than what I experienced growing up in America, is that there's a real focus on your local riding. Though I have plenty of issues with Canada, trust me. And I believe that we need to be rooted in what's natural. We need to consider what is natural. How might we be more rooted in what bodies and families and neighborhoods and local land, how might we be rooted in these things to know where we are, to know what it's to be free? And so he's a real big fan of Wendell Berry. You know, don't just bring a tractor in if you know it's going to do damage. You need to learn the land, and but once you learn the land, then you can actually be free within it. This is kind of Deneen's hope. But here's my problem with Deneen. What in the world is natural? It's a problem. How do you define natural? Because the ancient world, I would like to tell Deneen, was dominated by might is right. That nature or fate showed that women and slaves were inferior. Because natural law arguments are useful to those who believe them. But soon as you say, well, that's not natural, a person says, so what? Or it's not natural to you, or whatever. Because natural, what does natural mean? That's the problem. Nature in and of itself cannot be a sure foundation for morals. Francis Schaeffer said, nature is cruel and non-cruel. Actually, he said cruel and non-cruel, but anyway. I don't know if you ever noticed he mispronounces that word, but anyway. Cruel and non-cruel. So we cannot use nature as the basis upon which to build morals or morality. We need something more. I want to show you an example of why. I'm going to show you a materialist view of the Declaration of Independence. So the Declaration of Independence starts, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I misspelled inalienable. Okay. Well, this was considered natural to the deist of the day. But a guy named Yuval Harari, an Israeli philosopher, wrote a book called Sapiens, and he brings this to task through his Darwinian lens of what's natural, what's biological. He says, well, there's not God, and what can we say of equality? I mean, why would we want equality? Evolutionary success is through difference and exposing that difference. And we can't say that we're endowed by any creator when there's no God. We can say we're just born. Birds fly not because they have a right to fly, but because they have wings, he says. Birds fly not because they have a right to fly, but because they have wings. Evolutionary is blind and it just mutates. We need to recognize that. And he says, liberty, the word liberty is simply human illusion, a deceit. I'm paraphrasing him. He's saying liberty is simply a human illusion, a deceit. We deceive ourselves in order to cope biologically. But it's an illusion. It's then part of the imagination. But then let me quote him. From a biological point of view, it is meaningless to say that humans in democratic societies are free, whereas humans in dictatorships are unfree. He's saying, from a biological perspective, you know, when we say people in a liberal society is free, a person under a dictatorship is unfree. He goes, from a biological point of view, they're both unfree. We're living into an illusion because it's not natural. So he rewrote the preamble. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men evolve differently, that they are born with certain mutable characteristics, and that among these are life and the pursuit of pleasure. So you can consider what he considers natural, and the whole process of freedom and human dignity is lost. So how are we to recover the promises of liberalism and the achievements without going to what's natural or just what's natural? We need something more. We need the return of the Christian consensus. This is Francis Schaeffer's term. And this is my last point. So Francis Schaeffer, in his book, How Should We Then Live, dealt with these issues through a historical lens. He began with Rome and showed the influence of the Christian worldview, how it had an impact on philosophy, politics, economics, legalities, and art. However, it was a belief in a comprehensive Christian worldview that enabled those changes. He goes, but without that, what happens to the structure? So he points to a Roman bridge. He starts his series with this, and he ends the series with this, if you remember. He said, a Roman bridge is an architectural masterpiece. It's been there 2,000 years. I like to tell the local municipalities, can we build one of those? Okay. For a millennia, it has enabled horses, soldiers, and wagons to cross. But let's imagine a two-ton truck driving across it. It would collapse. It would not be able to handle the stress. He says that modern liberal society is like that bridge. It can function very well if too much pressure is not placed on it. However, if enough pressures come, it will collapse. And if that moment comes, we will turn to authoritarian governments as long as it continues to give us what we want. Well, I think that we've seen a lot of pressures placed on us in the past 20 years. You can look at inflation. Occupy Wall Street, 2008 crash. The pandemic has added to inflation with supply. Political terrorism, 9/11 as an example. Media manipulation, whether it's Fox News or CNN. Technological manipulation, control of information, fake news, Facebook, Twitter. Corporatism is another stressor, or a health crisis, COVID pandemic. So you put all these pressures on that little bridge of the autonomous human achieving liberal freedoms. What's going to happen is going to collapse, and we're going to turn to authoritarian figures to try to keep up with the demands when we're under so much stress. It becomes a huge temptation. And so modern pressures, Francis Schaeffer writes in the 1970s, of economic inflation and disparity, political terrorism, media manipulation, technological manipulation, corporatism, and the health crisis. But Francis Schaeffer said, at that point, it doesn't matter whether it comes from the left or from the right. It has no resources to stop authoritarianism or totalitarianism. Especially when we live in a society that has a loss of meaning outside of what I can create for myself. You have there was an article by a Christian interviewing all these atheists. But all these atheists have something in common. They long for religion to be true. They long for religion to be instilled in society. Here's Niall Ferguson. He says, it disturbs me that in so many ways, totalitarianism is gaining ground today. Totalitarianism was bad for many reasons, and one of the manifestations of its badness was its attack on religion. When I see totalitarianism gaining ground not only in China, but in subtle ways in our own society, that seems to be the disaster we really need to ward off. Why am I a conservative and not just a classical liberal? Because classical liberalism won't stop wokeism and totalitarianism. I'm not strong enough. I mean, it's not strong enough. Ultimately, we need the inherited ideas of a civilization and defenses against that particular form of disaster. He's talking about a particular type of authoritarianism. But he's saying if we don't have religious resources, if we don't have divine revelation, we have no way to stop authoritarianism. He says we need religion again. So he longs to believe, but he doesn't believe. And he knows that he's poorer for it. There was a guy named, or there is a guy, he's still around. He wrote a book a couple years back named Larry Seedentop. He's an American-born British historian, and he wrote a very acclaimed book called Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism. And in it, he does not start with John Locke. He starts with the Apostle Paul. He said the Apostle, and this guy's an agnostic. He points to the Apostle Paul proclaiming the Christ in the midst of a totalitarian regime of Rome, and that it begins Western liberalism through Jesus Christ. Because Paul's proclaiming that Jesus was God-man, man and God united, and that this man reconciled us to God. And through that, that is amazing news to anybody. It wasn't just to the elite. It was to every human being. Paul, you know, proclaims, he goes, we all have one Father. We're all one race, one tribe, one nation. And that in order to understand your place in that, you need to look to Jesus. And so he's saying that Paul proclaiming this message radically changed, revolutionized society. It revolutionized a totalitarian regime into something new, grassroots communities that redefined themselves. He said it destroyed fate. It destroyed the ancient family. Now, how often have you heard of Christianity destroying families? I mean, theoretically, theologically, that's what I mean. But he's saying it destroyed the ancient family because the ancient family was headed by a man, the oldest male, and this male was he worshipped, he kept the family fire stoked in order to worship the ancestors, and it would pass down to the son, the firstborn. And this man would be the head of a clan. And this, but this man, head of a clan, a huge community, would then go and he would talk with the other head men, and that would be politics. Okay. But when Christianity came in, it started reconstructing what was the power of the ancient family. It was no longer just the head man. But that even women could go and approach Jesus without their husbands. That women were equal to their husbands. That children were equal to their parents in terms of dignity before Jesus. And so early Christian thought radically changed these relationships as not natural, but to designed, created, endowed. And so the belief was that all were equal in judgment and in the possibility of grace. There was neither slave nor free, male nor female, Greek nor Jew. That's radical. That's radical in that society. It was unheard of. It wasn't natural, but it was revealed. And it was believed because it started changing people's lives. And so these slaves, these women, the former prostitutes, the masters, they all joined together in unity, in equality before Jesus. And it started changing society by that radical reorganization. And so this is where Seedentop's saying this is the beginning of Western liberalism. But it wasn't just self-interest. They were all unique and individual, so that expresses its diversity, but its unity was held by their union and fealty to Jesus. Jesus was the one Lord. There was one God. And so they didn't use their freedom for what they wanted, but they used their freedom to serve. Be slaves to one another in love, Paul says. They were not to consider their own interests first, but others. And so it was a voluntary association where they were unique in their individuality, in their freedom, and their dignity in order to be to serve. And so what happened is that this motivated them not to only serve each other, but to go out and serve society. And what happened is that, and Seedentop goes through a whole history from Apostle Paul to the Reformation, Enlightenment. But he basically said that, for example, the bishops were the people who understood the women, the slaves, the poor, and so they started becoming elected. Those who were at character were elected to oversee them. And so Seedentop points to this as the beginning of popular vote, looking for people of character. That it shaped law towards slaves, that Charlemagne went out, and he didn't have a crystal clean record, but he required that even the slaves in the field had an oath for him. That he didn't just ask the master for their oath, but he asked the slave because he saw them as having dignity and tried to reform laws in order to have better treatment of slaves. And so slowly out of this conviction, it moved out into changing authoritarian societies into one that was diverse but unified in Christ. But without this form, without this conviction, it all collapses and it turns toward authoritarianism. So let me just conclude. So the fall of the Berlin Wall was a wonderful moment. But I wouldn't consider that it was just that we've returned to this authoritarian tendencies because of just emotions out of whack. And I wouldn't say that we just need to return to what's natural, but we need to return to this Christian conviction and work out of our Christian convictions with one another. You know, even at Labrie, we disagree on exactly how to welcome people during COVID. I don't know if you've ever had that debate at parties, at conferences. It's like, how can we welcome people with differences? And we disagreed, and it was pretty tense, but we decided, we prayed together, and we're like, our unity in Christ is more important than these things. So how can we serve and love one another in how we do this within our own context as best we can? And let's forgive where we don't do well. Right? And that building out as a microcosm into society. But if we don't return to that and don't speak out, then authoritarian tendencies will remain. So I'm going to finish with a quote from Francis Schaeffer from How Shall We Then Live? And it's his call to Christians among authoritarian governments. If we as Christians do not speak out as authoritarian governments grow from within or come from outside, eventually we and our children will be the enemy of society and the state. No truly authoritarian government can tolerate those who have a real absolute by which to judge its arbitrary absolutes, and who speak out and act upon that absolute. This was the issue with the early church in regard to the Roman Empire. And though the specific issue will in all probability take a different form than Caesar worship, the basic issue of having an absolute by which to judge the state and society will be the same. Here is a sentence to memorize. To make no decision in regard to the growth of authoritarian government is already a decision for it.